how they manifest our kindred with God, or kindredship with God. So he starts out with, this is the message that we have heard from the beginning. When did we first see the beginning in John? Okay, 1 John 1, right? In 1 John 1, he speaks of the fact that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon with our hands. Now, remember, the beginning is where the apostles were first given the inspiration. The Gnostics, of course, didn't come in until how late? I mean, obviously, are there any Gnostics among the Jews? Do we see anything about this in Acts chapter 1 through 15? All the doctrines are Jewish problems, right? And so the Gentile problems really didn't start coming in. I think 1 Thessalonians was written about 52, and the church was established either 30 or 33, depending on how you want to date the birth of Christ. It's, some people think 0, some people think 6 BC. But anyway, it's been a while. So they're Johnny come latelys. The teachings that they are bringing into the church are not from the beginning. And of course, this concept of love, you remember John 13, 30, what is it, 33 and 34? 34 and 35? This new commandment Jesus gave, brand new, never been given before, because of the point of reference. Before it was, you love your neighbor as yourself. Now,
love one another as,
I have loved you. Okay? And so, this is the message that we've heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Now, the basis of this love, we're going to get into this a little bit more later, but the basis of this love, with sin, we are selfishly using people, right? I mean, when we are involved, you know, you look at the Ten Commandments, we're either selfish in our relationship with God, taking His name in vain, violating His Sabbath, bowing down to other gods, or we are selfish using others, stealing, committing adultery, murder, false witness, coveting. We're not looking at people as they live their lives with a right to live their lives and to have the same enjoyments and the same freedom that we do. But those who are deeply involved, and not even deeply involved, those who are walking in the darkness of sin, what use do they want to make of others? Are we wanting to help them? Is that what sin is? No. And so this concept of love, when Jesus came, did he come to use us? Did he come to get things from us? Was his purpose to gain? No. His purpose was to be a blessing. And when we get into chapter 4 and 5, and we see that God is love, what's that really emphasizing? God is love.
His very nature.
Okay. His very nature is giving. He's not selfish in any way, shape, matter, or form. Which, when we think of power, what do we generally think of? If someone has power, what do they normally do with it?
They take,
and they use, and they often make life miserable. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, where he talks about oppression, and some of these countries on earth, have you read a little bit about what goes on in North Korea? Would we want to live there? We are so blessed to live in a country where essentially our country is really founded on love. And it's founded on this type of love, which is everyone being allowed the freedom to pursue their own what? Remember the Constitution? Bill of Rights?
Happiness.
To pursue happiness, right? In the pursuit of happiness, that this is one of the inalienable rights given to us by God. Is that correct? Did God create us for happiness? Look in the Garden of Eden. Did he create us to be miserable, or did he create us to be happy? He created us to be happy. He gave us all these things and said, be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth. You're in my image. You can do whatever you want to do with these things. Because there wasn't any sin back then, so they too were loved. Carl?
Yeah, but like God did do that. But the man has oppressed man through the centuries, and everybody haven't had a freedom.
Right. Right. And when people like that come into the church, remember we talked about Constantine legalizing Christianity about 1340. This was about the same time as that Nicene Council that we talk about, the anti-Nicene, post-Nicene, and Nicene Fathers, the writings that were going on back then. When he legalized Christianity, he told all the politicians, if you want to keep your position, you have to become a Christian. So all of a sudden, we get this great influx of what kind of people into the church? Loving, compassionate, sacrificing people, right? That's one thing about politics. Even if they go in, I'm not going to say that most of these people are falsely promising. I think a lot of them really mean it. Here's what I'm going to do when I get there. But what happens when they get there? Well, it's not that easy, and they too start to become what's in it for me. Carl?
My mom worked for a banker back in Kansas when I was growing up, and he ran for the Senate. And he had great ideas for the people. And when he got there, he told us later, he couldn't do what he wanted to
right.
do because the others would not allow him to.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So
and
he was an honest, honest politician going to government to try to do things for his people, but the powers that be were would not let Allah
right.
do that.
That's right. Okay, so coming back to the text here in verse 11, we see that what Paul or what John is emphasizing here is the distinction between how the Gnostics are developing their religious convictions and their manner of life, and they are not people of love. They are people who. And most people who become Christians, unless they make that change, this is what's going to happen in the church. And all church problems come not from people of love, but from people who are selfish. So in verse 11, for this is the message you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. And then he brings up Cain. And I've always found it fascinating that if you read the story of Cain and Abel in Genesis chapter 4, you really don't pick up the information. Matter of fact, it's pretty much new revelation when Jesus says in Luke chapter, 13 or 14, that Abel was a prophet. Do we pick that up in Genesis chapter 4, that he was a prophet? And that he was king, Cain killed him because he was testifying as a prophet. In other words, he was preaching by inspiration to Cain, and Cain killed him. And of course, here we learn the real reason he killed his brother. It's because his works were wicked and his brothers were righteous. Now, what do we call the emotion when somebody else gets praise and you don't and it makes you angry?
Envy.
All right, envy, jealousy.
Jealousy.
Do we pick that up in Genesis chapter 4?
Yeah.
A little bit, but not much. I mean, all it says is Abel spoke to his brother and Cain killed him. And so we can't really, with Deuteronomy 29:29, we can't really put it together. But here we find several things. And then, of course, in Hebrews chapter 11, it says, by what did Abel offer a more excellent sacrifice?
Faith.
By faith. So now we find, you know, we'll never know what the problem was between what Cain brought and what Abel brought. Whether it was not enough, whether it was he was supposed to bring a blood sacrifice and he didn't. I mean, I've heard a lot of different reasons why. Doesn't really matter. What's the big difference in Hebrews chapter 11 between Abel's sacrifice and Cain's sacrifice?
Obedience.
Well, faith, right? By faith. And you're right. I mean, that's the next step. But where does faith come from? Okay, faith comes by hearing the word of God. So God told both of them what to do. See, we can put it together now. God told both of them what to do. And Abel did it by faith. He trusted the Lord with all of his heart. What did Cain do?
He did his own thing.
He embellished it somehow or another. And when his countenance fell, what generally, if your child is beaming because they're bringing you something and you say, I don't have any use for this, what happens to their face? So Cain had an expectation. He had an expectation that God was going to be very happy with this sacrifice, either because of sincerity. Do we have people today who think that their sincerity should be enough for God to be really pleased with what they're doing? And so is their countenance going to fall when Jesus says, "Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness"? So, okay, go ahead, Brian.
Well, I was going to say, even after his countenance fell, God told him, if you do well, you'll be accepted.
Yeah.
So he reinforced the fact that if you're just obedient, we're fine.
Right, but if you just repent. If you repent and you do the first works, but, and apparently Abel either added to that or said it again, but what he couldn't do with God, can you lash out at God? Can you hit God? Can you do something to God? No. So who do you go after?
The messenger.
The messenger. Okay, the messenger. So not as Cain, who was of the wicked one. And you say, well, he was of the wicked one because he murdered his brother. But that's really not the point here, because it's not the murder that he focuses on, but the reason behind the murder. So if you look carefully at verse 12, not as Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous. And as I say, you got to plug in some things in between there. If you are a person of love and you want what's best for others and they get something that you don't get, and this is the real purpose of both envy and jealousy. Envy and jealousy are good emotions given to us to do what? I see somebody get something I want, and what do I say? If I work as hard as they did, I can get that. Right? Is that, or I can go to them and find out how did you do this? This is the purpose. Matter of fact, we have two different words. We have jealousy, and then if we put a Z on it, what is it? Zealous, right? Zealous and jealous come from the same Greek word. What's the difference between the two? One's using the emotion properly, one's using the emotion sinfully. Every emotion we have is very good. But some of them are really prone to abuse and misuse. They make us selfish. Hatred, anger, jealousy, envy are all emotions that, for the most part, we don't know how to handle them. We don't know. We've lost the ability to keep things in perspective. Does God get angry?
Yes.
Yeah. Does he ever violate the act of or the emotions of love and acting in the best interest? No, he does not. It's just that, unfortunately, God is not mocked. You reap what you sow, and if you make this a problem. All right, so let's jump ahead here. I'm going to skip over all the dark stuff. All right, anything else on Cain that we need to draw from this? Anybody want to add anything else about Cain? What did Jude say about him in verse 11? Jeannie?
Woe to those that go in his way.
Okay, woe to them who go in the way of Cain. So the path of Cain, is Jesus a path in John 14:6? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one will come to the Father. So Jesus is that path. When he says, The path that leads to life is straitened and narrow, who's he talking about? He's talking about himself. He's talking about what he has come to reveal. And we've talked about this in the past. Why would Jesus make the way so hard? Why did Jesus make the gate so narrow and the way so difficult? And of course, the obvious answer is he didn't. Well, why is it so difficult? Because there's so many people who don't want to do it that when those who want to do it, for example, today, when we preach the gospel to someone and we tell them you're going to have to attend every service and you're going to have to give up all these activities and you're going to have to redo your life, what do people say?
It's too much.
Man, that's I can't believe you're so out of the mainstream. What does that mean? Is that way hard then? Is it difficult? Well, no, but because of comparison, it becomes that way. Did I see a hand back there? Oh, Carl?
One of the things with our society is the fact that Cain's attitude was the fact that he wouldn't admit he was wrong.
Right.
And we see that prevalent in our society today.
Yeah, and that creates great anger, doesn't it? And this is the fear. Let's move into the next verse so we can talk about this a little bit more. Verse 13. marvel not, or don't be amazed, don't be shocked, don't be surprised, don't think that this is amazingly out of ordinary. Now, normally it is. If you go into work and you bring in some good ideas, some good truth that'll make more money for the business, what do they say? Don't they say thank you? Aren't they happy if you give them good ideas, even though they have to make some changes? But if they can see the bottom line will increase, they're going to make some changes. But when you bring the gospel to people for eternal life, what's their response most of the time?
Total rejection.
They reject it. They become angry. You lose a friend. And we are accustomed, because from our youth we've found this, that if we do something that everyone else disapproves of, what does that mean? In everyday life, you know, as mom and dad, if we do something mom and dad don't approve of, should we be amazed and say, that doesn't matter to me? No, that's normal. And if I come to school and I do something that's wrong, it's going to be normal to be disapproved of. But when you bring the truth to someone and they hate you for it, what's the first obvious conclusion you're going to draw? I must have done something wrong. You remember those days when you were first preaching and you figured, well, if I just presented it better, or if I had just come up with a better way to put this, this wouldn't have happened and it's all my fault. Anybody ever feel like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like that. But what about Jesus? Could you put it any better than he did? And what were they constantly doing to him? And so don't be amazed if the world hates you. Now, hate's a little stronger. Then, and we'll talk about that. Carl?
I went to an older preacher one time when I had that problem. And he said, Carl, a man's going to believe what he wants to believe. And don't leave God out of the picture. You can't do it by yourself.
Right.
Always keep God in the picture. And if they don't believe you, then they believe Jesus.
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly right. If they won't sacrifice for God, even if you are the most charismatic and friendly and you're over there playing games with them and just doing everything you can to ease them into the gospel, but is there enough love for a man to make the kind of sacrifices you have to make to become a Christian? See, if you don't have the motivations that God has set up, there's no way you're going to make it. And I've seen this in the past. Sometimes I tell Jeannie, these people are living way above what they're capable of living. And they're doing it for us. And within a few months, guess what? They found something that they didn't know was going to happen, and they're not willing to do that. All right, so the world hates you. Now, there's a couple of passages. On my page, it's 91. It's right above verse 14. So if you look on your page to verse 14, which should be right in the middle of the page or thereabouts. In John 15, verses 18 through 20, it says, if the world hates you, you know it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. So is it personal?
No,
it's not personal. Is there anything I can change in my personality or in my demeanor that's going to stop this?
No.
If I change my convictions and go back to the world, will that stop it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then what? See, this is the problem, and I've emphasized this in the past with the idea of peer pressure. Normally when we think of peer pressure, what are we thinking about? Worldly peer pressure. Is there spiritual peer pressure? Hebrews 12, verse 1, we are compassed about by a great cloud of witnesses. And if you make them your friend, then that peer pressure, the peer pressure, in other words, is God watching me and that friend watching me? Who am I going to disappoint? Can I keep both of them? No. Like Amos says, can two walk together? So if I agree with God, I'm going to walk with God, and what's that person going to do? They're going to walk away. If I walk away with that person, what's God going to do? See, he's not going to go with me. So it's always a constant pressure, peer pressure, between our heritage and our history and our forefathers and brethren, or the people of the world today. And for a lot of people who don't have a strong faith, which side is stronger, the people of this world or God? Sometimes all we can see is the people of this world. All right, verse 14. We know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brethren. Now, this takes us back to Jesus' statement in John 13. What do we have to do so that all men will know we are his disciples? Preach the truth? Hold to the truth? That's not what he said. What did he say? You have love for one. And so this is going to be a tangible thing. So we know that we are out of darkness or out of death into life. So what John is saying here is, and let's not lose sight of this, if you love the brethren and you love God, are you going to be doing things like we do in the Church of Christ if you love God? And if you love your brethren? In other words, if I love you, what am I going to preach on the first day of the week? Am I going to preach what you want to hear or what you need to hear and what you have to hear? So is that a love? So if I love the brethren, then you are going to hear the truth. And if you love the brethren, what are you going to do? You're going to act on it. So don't get the wrong idea here. He's not really excluding doctrine from this. If we're really going to act in the best interests of other people, then preaching the truth to them and expecting the truth from them and conforming your life. You remember Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, though I was free from all men, I brought myself under bondage. To the Jew I became as a Jew. To the Greek I became, or to those without law I became as without law. So he's acting in their best interest with the goal of bringing them to the Lord. So the love that Jesus is describing, which is truly in the best interest, did Abel love Cain?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the love of the brethren. That's the kind of love God is talking about here. So we know we've passed out of death into life when we are truly acting in the best interest of other people. When we're talking to them about their souls and we're talking to them about their relationship with God. And of course, the other side of it is also true. James said, if you say to someone, be warmed and filled, but you don't give them the needs, what does that profit?
Nothing.
See, that's not love. It's not love. In other words, good intentions, are they love? Well, they're first step of love, but if you never get past them, in other words, I'm going to call this person, or I'm going to have this person over, or I'm going to go visit them, or I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that, but we never do it. Is that love? See, it's love in purpose, but is it love indeed? It's not. It's not. Okay, so let's go ahead. And I want to talk a little bit about this. We spent a lot of time on this a few years ago when we went through 2 Peter 1. And I think we had a series on it a while back. And I'm actually thinking about preaching on it again at some point. But this concept of the two words for love, I think it's critical that we understand that the Greeks had a common word for love, and Jesus didn't use it. He could have used it. But instead, he used a word that is not used by the Greek culture. The Greek did not use this word. They didn't see this word as having any value. It is absent from all of the philosophers and all of the writings that you can read back in that time. They just don't use this word. They didn't see it as something that had any value to be so self-deprecating to the Greek, as according to most people. If you have a football team and one guy is just really hurting the other team and acting in terrible ways, is he the hero? Do you want a humble guy on the football field who turns the other cheek and doesn't want to knock anybody down? Do you want somebody like that? So in the world, this isn't seen as a strength. It's seen as a weakness, unless it is properly understood. And that's how the Greeks saw it. So the first word, as we noted, is a selfish word. And I don't mean selfish in the sense of evil, but if you say I love something, what has to be? I love playing golf. What has to be? You enjoy it. You get pleasure from it. If you don't have pleasure in it, are you going to say I love it? If I have a car, it's breaking down every week. Am I going to say, I love this car? No. But if the car is always reliable and I've used it, I've had it in my car, I think I've had 12 years now, I haven't had any problems with it, oh, I love that car. It's been a great car. Now, if I ever stop loving it, what am I going to do?
Get rid of it.
I'll sell it. I'm not going to act in the best interest of that car. I'm not going to chunk a bunch of money in it because that's not what's best for me. And I don't have to. Do I have to have agape love to a car or to a hobby? No, you wouldn't have that. But with people, with hobbies, with things, if I say I love them, it requires personal feelings of enjoyment, pleasure, or satisfaction. And if you don't have any of those things, is it really honest to say I love it? And so, but the word Jesus used doesn't have any of those things. Let me see if I can find it on here. I'm looking at my new paper. Yeah, on the, and again, I'm not sure exactly where yours is. Mine's on page 93. And it's the passage that says the verb and the noun and total. And there's a 5-to-1 ratio for every time phileo is used, or the love of pleasure, the love that draws us to something. 5-to-1, agape is used instead. So there's a real, and it's interesting that the uses of phileo are, of the 55 times it's used, 44 times it's in the Gospels. So by the time Jesus died, that word had receded into the background of Revelation, because it's only used, 44 out of 55? It's only used 11 times when we get out of the Gospels. So as the people grew into an understanding of agape love, this term really was set aside, because do we need to be trained in liking things that we like? In other words, does the gospel have to teach us how to like certain things and not like other things? Pretty natural, isn't it? When you met the person that you decided you wanted to marry, generally speaking, there is this sense of, we really enjoy being around this person. And of course, if that goes away and it isn't replaced with agape love, then what happens? And that's why our divorce rate is so high today. So, agape love, again, is, well, as Jesus put it, agape love is laying down your life for your friends. George?
I think we as a society really fouled up by the number of times that we say, I love.
Right.
When we really aren't what I would call loving them. It's a like, I like it.
I like it a lot, yeah. Yeah. So, Jeannie, I like you a lot. No, I know what you're saying. I like my car a lot. I don't, you know, that's a good point. That is a good point. Okay, so we come now to verse 13, which, once we get past all the dark pages, and I put these in here for those who really want to go beyond just a cursory understanding, and most of us already have this understanding, so we don't really need to go through that. But in the latter part there, at the very bottom where the black or the dark stops, it says, he that loveth not abideth in death. Now, the first loveth is a present active participle, which means we're taking a continuous action, turning it into a noun. So the lover does not abide in death. When the man stops loving, we can't call him a lover anymore. And of course, in our society, the term has a different connotation, the lover, or the one who is continually loving. But in this language, again, it's the agape love. So the person who is continually functioning with the best interests of other people. Now, this is how we come out of the darkness. If you have a sin that you're struggling with, if you could just see it clearly, you could just see it as the selfish abuse or the lack of regard for another person. So if you go through the lust of the flesh in, say, Galatians chapter 5, And you look at the different ones. Is fornication a loving, sacrificing way to treat other people? No, it's a very selfish thing. And same thing with passion, and the same thing with adultery. Then we move to murder. Is that a pretty unselfish way to treat someone, take their life? Well, no. And you keep going. The anger, the wrath, the bitterness, the hatred, the jealousies, these are all things that are the opposite of love. And so if we could see that our mandate from God is to always treat other people with the best possible outcome for them, what does that do to most sins? Is it easier to turn the other cheek when you are trying to act in their best interest instead of getting what you want? And so love changes everything. It changes our concepts of sin, and it changes our concepts of how we're using our abilities and the opportunities that God has given to us. All right, let me catch up here. Okay. All right, verse 15. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer. Where do you get that? Remember the Sermon on the Mount?
Matthew 5.
Okay, Matthew 5. You have heard that you shall not kill, but whoever kills shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. Now, some add without a cause. And of course, the basic idea here is, can you be angry for a few moments? In Ephesians chapter 4, be angry, don't sin, and limit it to what? Don't let
the sun go down,
which means, can you take it tomorrow? You know, some of us go to sleep, we wake up, boy, we get that fire going again. We go through everything, we remember how angry we are, and we get it all worked up again. Is that what God says we should do with that anger? No. Because, as is put in the scriptures, the wrath of man does not work the righteousness of God. So, and here we have, again, a very, very strong concept, and that is, if you continually hate your brother, that makes you a murderer in the eyes of God. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. So, the idea... Well, we're supposed to love everyone. What does hate do to love? Well, it short circuits it, right? They're polar opposites. You can't hate and want the worst for someone and be looking for ways to make their lives miserable, while at the same time wanting to act in their best interests. So since murder, and I guess we could bring one other point up, and that is in John 8:44. What did Jesus say to those Jews? You are of your father,
the devil,
and it's his will you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and you seek to kill me. Your hatred of me has reached a level where you seek to kill me. Now, you haven't found an opportunity yet. If you want to kill someone, but you haven't found an opportunity yet, are you a murderer or not? Well, to men you're not. What about to God? You're a murderer. And so, you know, those of us who, and hopefully there's no one here like that, but those of us who have grudges, those of us who can remember certain people with disgust and with irritation, we haven't forgiven them yet, we haven't restored them, we still wouldn't act in their best interest if they came into our presence. Is that a Christian attitude? Is that one of those things that Jesus talked about in Matthew 5, if you have brought your gift to the altar and you remember that you have ought against someone, what should you do?
Leave the
gift and resolve it. So, can we take the Lord's Supper with a deep, abiding grudge that we've had for 20 years and expect the Lord to be happy with that?
No.
So, this is something that removes the darkness. Once you see this and your conscience begins to work, what's going to have to happen? You're going to have to get rid of it, right? You're going to have to get rid of it and whatever it takes. If it maybe it's something that they don't even know about and you don't have to go to them, you just need to stop it. But then on the other hand, maybe it's something, the only way to resolve it is to go talk to him and say, I'm really sorry, I've felt this way, I've never really forgiven you for this event, and I wanted to talk about it a little more and put it behind us. And that's what Christianity teaches us. And that's not what the Gnostics teach. And of course, it's really not what they're teaching in the denominations. This, again, is one of those higher, difficult things that most people don't want to hear about. They don't want to hear about that. All right, verse 16. Hereby, or in this, or by this, or this is the critical indicator. Here's how we know love. And so he goes on. I lost my 13. Okay, I'll have to go over here. Okay, hereby we know love, because he laid down his life for us. Now, is that any different than the new commandment that I give to you? That you love one another as I have loved you? Well, what did he do for us? How did he love us? He gave his life for us. So, we know love when he laid down his life for us. So, what's the degree we ought to lay down our life? You know, I think I told you this a few years ago, that when I first brought this up to the people in Malawi, would you die for your wife? First it was a painful silence, and then they all started laughing. Which tells me what? They wouldn't. They'd never thought about that before. That's a concept that is foreign to them. And they don't have books like we do. I mean, from a young age, we've read books about chivalry and about men who do things that are nice and take care of women, and they don't have that. Their attitude toward women is, how can we use them? How can we subjugate them and make them serve us? And people like that, if they have an opportunity to die for them, what would they do? They wouldn't do it. Now, is that what, if after 20 years of being a Christian, if that's still their attitude, then what does that mean?
They're not converted.
Yeah, they haven't been preached to. And I haven't been doing this long enough to be able to go back and ask them again and see if they've changed their thinking on that. But that's what has to happen in order for a relationship, whether it's in a marriage relationship or whether it's just in a congregational relationship, there's a very simple answer, and that is, we know love because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. So that gives us the full context of a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. Lord, does that mean I should go to the degree of dying for them? Yeah. And, of course, then I'd die for my wife, but I won't do anything else for her. What, if the opportunity to die ever comes up, I'll go that far, but I never do it now. What is that telling her?
There's no love there.
Yeah, you're not going to die for me. You're talking now. You won't even open the door for me. You won't even take out the trash for me. You don't do anything for me. And you're telling me you're going to love me? And so when it says lay down our lives, that means this is the highest level that it could go. What about lower things? Well, they just naturally come into that. So we ought, or we have an obligation, we have a duty. Matter of fact, this word, as you notice where it says we ought to lay down our lives, this word means to owe money, to be in debt. That's how it's normally used. I owe you. IOU. If you give someone an IOU, what does that mean? It means you owe them something, right? This is what I owe you. Well, and what did Paul say in Romans 14 about that? Owe no man anything except your debt of love. That debt of love, that's the only thing that we should look toward. So then he goes on, and again, whoso has this world's good. So I die for you, but if you're starving, don't come to me. Well, what is that telling you and me and God? Is that hypocrisy?
Yes.
To talk about how many people we would die for and how much we love people, but we never do anything. We never do anything. So if you have the world's goods and your brother is in need, And again, this takes us, if you look on your notes, to James chapter 2. If a brother or sister be naked or in lack of daily food, and one of you say, go in peace, be warmed and filled. Now, that's the attitude that agape love would create within us. But what's next? You can't just have good intentions. You can't just tell yourself, I'm a really good person because I feel like this. Now, is it a good thing to feel like that? I mean, to want to help these people? Well, yeah, that's a good thing. But you've got to go the next step. Carl?
There's also a brother that may be in need because he mismanages funds. The first thing to show love to him is to show him where he can correct that, his problem.
Right.
And then help him beyond that point.
Right. Yeah, that's that old proverb, you can either give someone a fish or teach them how to fish, yeah. Which is better.
Yeah. You know, in you can. In our society today, we have many people that mismanage the funds.
Right.
We live in a land of privilege. But we have, I think the last thing was we have some 6,000 people that's homeless in Denver. 6,000.
Right.
Well, somebody has failed themselves along the way in living in a land of opportunity.
Right. And yet, if you say to them, I'm not going to help you because you should help yourself, what are those who overhear you going to think? You don't love them. How could you call yourself a Christian when you won't give them something? And I've heard that for years. I'm sure you've heard it for years. Sometimes when people come through that door and you look at them, they always come in 5 minutes before services are over and they got this dire need. And I usually will call or pursue it. And I know that's the attitude here as well. And if the people I call say, don't help them, this has been going on for years. So I come out and say, I'm not going to help you. What are they going to think or what are they going to say? You're not a Christian. Christians just give. Jesus just gave. I mean, God so loved the world and he gave his son. So, well, what's the last part of that verse? That whoever believes, and faith without works is dead. So not everyone who believes Jesus, not everyone who calls Jesus Lord is going to enter the kingdom of heaven. Carl?
He also said if you don't work, you don't eat.
Yes, he does say that. So, but we're not dealing with that here. We're dealing with someone who has a legitimate need because of a legitimate situation. For example, that famine last year, was it their fault that they didn't get rain for 2 years in a row? That they plowed their fields and they put the fertilizer in and they did everything they should do and they didn't get the rain? And we say, I'm not helping you. You need to learn how to work harder. Is that... No, that's not that. This verse is dealing with that. There are legitimate situations where people have a need. And when that comes up, if we shut our compassion from that person, then it's wrong. But as you say, the second time, the third time, the fourth time, at some point, you begin to start thinking, this person's going to have to learn to take care of this situation without continually relying on others. And so these people who go from church to church to church, needing help here and help there, am I shutting up compassion if I don't help them? No. I'm trying to teach them something. If a man won't work, neither let him eat. Because is he going to go to heaven if he won't work? So we put a bet. You know, it's like the guy who really wants the money for alcohol, and we're gonna show compassion. So we're even gonna give more money than they're asking for. Is that compassion? Because what are they gonna do with that money? They're gonna get drunk. You want to subsidize drunkenness or drug abuse? Absolutely not. Okay. Let's pick up in verse 18 next week. And it's too bad that we didn't get a little further along because we're going to start a new section. But we'll go ahead and start in verse 18 and we'll pick it up from there. Thank you.